You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands that I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're talking about the tyranny of evidence-based medicine. Sounds good. Medicine should be evidence-based. It shouldn't be based on folklore. It shouldn't be based on superstition. But it turns out that EBM, which is the acronym assigned to evidence-based medicine, is now being used as a cudgel to make doctors adhere to restrictive guidelines in treating their patients. In effect, we've got paint-by-numbers medicine as a result of EBM. And a major critic of EBM today, our guest, the author of this article, The Tyranny of Evidence-Based Medicine, Dr. Richard Amerling. He's a board-certified nephrologist. He's taught in medical school. He is currently Associate Medical Director of America's Frontline Doctors, a controversial organization because they advocate nimble strategies for dealing with COVID. Some of the medications that are not approved by the mainstream, things like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, and also a staunch advocate of private practice medicine. He is a past president of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. Okay, let's get to the AMA. The AMA is said to be the voice of American medicine, but turns out only about 15% of doctors belong to the American Medical Association. They don't see it in their interest to belong and pay the hefty dues, maybe get a discount on rental cars or on life insurance, a few percent off on medical software. But where did AMA go wrong, and how has it been commandeered? Recently, AMA has gone woke. They issued a bunch of guidelines, which are very strange, almost Orwellian, with newspeak about how to address minority groups. You can no longer talk about ex-convicts. You have to refer to them as disadvantaged people who have, there's some circuitous language that they use that is supposedly not prejudicial and suggests that people are victims inevitably of the system.
Yeah, Ron, I mean, all of these organizations, I think, are getting hijacked and have been getting hijacked by the left. The left has always been extremely good at infiltrating these big name organizations. They've been doing it for years. You just get a few people in there, a few staffers, and they run policy. I mean, the figurehead presidents and the vice presidents and the various officers come and go. It's really the permanent staff that run these organizations. And you get a few lefties in there, and they're going to change the policy around before you know it. There's not very good control, which is, by the way, one of the reasons why AAPS has been so good and been so solid. They don't let that kind of stuff happen. I mean, we have a board. We have careful rules how board members are selected. And that's how we've been able to stay on course and on track over many decades now. AMA, no such thing. They got co-opted by government very early on, who bought the rights to their coding books, the coding systems that they own. They own the property rights, the copyright on that stuff. So that's a big source of their revenue. They don't make much money from dues. There aren't many members. I think they they probably, you know, they get to the medical students and they get to the residents and they say, yes, come join the AMA. We'll give you this. We'll give you that. And they join and they either don't ever quit, or they forget that this is really a left-wing organization now that's part of the government. So they have been pro-vaccine. They have been, I mean, pro these COVID shots. I'm not talking about vaccines in general. Pro
and,
these
and
shots.
Pro-mandate. Pro-mandate as well, which is... Which
and
is,
pro-mandate. Yeah. Yeah. And pro-mandate, absolutely. So they have become tyrannical, now apparently woke. You know, they're pushing a rewrite of medical literature to include all the mandatory woke terms and explanations for the new reality, which is that there is no such thing as actually disease. It's all a question of white supremacy and victimization and oppression of some sort. When I first saw this, I thought it was the Babylon Bee, Ron. I kid you not. I thought this is someone sending me a spoof here. No, this can't be true. But they're serious about this stuff.
Well, here's an example. I'm going to be giving an example from their guidelines. You can find it at the AMA website. The term meritocracy. You know, when we were, you know, working hard to get into med school and to perform well and then, you know, obtain career positions, you know, it was a big commitment. And, you know, we successfully entered the field of medicine. You know, we pursued careers. Here's what they say about meritocracy. A social system where social advancement is based on one's capabilities and merits rather than family, wealth, or social background and connections. It is also associated with a commonly heard phrase of, quote, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, which I guess is not a PC thing to say anymore. Pulling yourself up by... Were you born with a silver spoon in your mouth, Richard?
Hardly.
Okay.
Hardly. No. I had a struggle.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So this idea of individualism, meritocracy, capitalism itself is thought to be based on racial exclusions, and you know that it is inherently a racist concept. According to this is the American Medical Association. I'm not sure what this has to do with medicine. But that's what you're going to get. Okay, so you know, they're what's going on? I mean, when we talk about you know, big pharma, we know that big pharma is going to try and gain an advantage. But how did all these forces align? Government and big pharma and the health bureaucracy, which is headed by Fauci, and of course there's the NIH and the CDC, the universities, the medical schools. And then the media, how did they all kind of align around a rather tyrannical perspective on COVID?
I think that the principal players are Pfizer and the big pharma companies that are profiting beyond their wildest dreams from this. I mean, Pfizer reported over $20 billion in sales in a quarter. The biggest drug they ever had before this was Lipitor, another loser, by the way, frankly, based on crappy EBM studies, which we should get into more a little bit because I need
to
go into more
depth. Yeah, we can actually take a segue to that because I think that prior to COVID, that was actually one of the biggest successful campaigns to inculcate fear and paranoia about cholesterol in the American public and then to market drugs, which, you know, look, I prescribe statins. You've prescribed statins. There's a time and place for these, but the universal application of statins to everyone who has borderline cholesterol is folly.
Exactly. And this is one of the reasons why I knew from the beginning that this Pfizer shot was bogus because of my experience in how they marketed Lipitor, which was their prior big blockbuster. I mean, and they would have a billion or two a year, and that was great for them. Now, by the way, they've had nothing since. From what I hear, they're sort of like, you know, they were in bad shape before
the COVID came. The so-called pipeline had dried up. The pipeline had dried up.
Had dried up completely.
Yeah, because they, you know, they didn't want to take a chance on Alzheimer's drugs because they would all crash and burn. And they really kind of were in a little bit of a funk.
Yeah, absolutely. They were in bad shape, and their shareholders, I think their share price was beaten down, rightfully so. So this has been the goose that lays the millions of golden eggs for them, like they've never seen before. And they have so much financial gain here that anything is possible. And I therefore attribute most of what we are seeing to them and the other big pharma players. Moderna, which is partially owned by the government, apparently. They own the patent on their shot. Gates financed them. Gates has money everywhere. Gates is a big player in all this, but we don't need to get into that. China is a big player in censorship, and we're kind of following the Chinese model of state-sponsored tyranny in pretty much everything we've done from the beginning, including the lockdowns, masking, et cetera, none of which helped, all of which made things worse. But I really do think pharma, and the whole Lipitor story was instructive to me, because Lipitor, by the way, I don't prescribe statins simply because I think that they lower the number, but they don't really improve the patient, right, and they probably are much more harmful than good. But Lipitor was sold exactly the same way that these shots have been sold, using the relative risk reduction, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I think we talked about this on a prior show, using the relative risk reduction. The Lipitor advertisement said, reduce your risk of a heart attack by 36% or some number like that, right?
Sounds good.
When you looked at the fine print, it said there was 1% fewer heart attacks in the treatment group compared to the placebo group. Mm-hmm. So they took a 1% actual risk reduction and created a 33 or 36% relative risk reduction by pure mathematical trickery. So, for example, I think there was something like 90. There was 3% heart attacks in the placebo group, 2% in the Lipitor group. So that 1% difference, you divide by the three, that's your 33%.
Right.
So that's how they did it. So when I saw the 95% efficacy numbers for Pfizer, first of all, just as a skeptical scientific clinician,
right.
When you see,
have you ever seen a vaccine that's 95? I mean, I'm not pretty sure. You know, in the realm of respiratory illnesses, that's not happening. Why would that happen when the flu vaccine is so relatively inefficacious?
How likely is it that three or four brand new so-called vaccines, which are actually, you know, gene therapy based treatments, would come out and have such astoundingly good results with so few sites? It is absolutely inconceivable that this could be true.
Right.
Just as a skeptical clinician of many years duration, I didn't believe it from the beginning. And then when I saw this 95%, I said, that's got to be a relative risk reduction. And sure enough, this guy, Ronald Brown, is a very clever PhD from our home turf in New York City, wrote a nice article explaining how they did it. And it's the same thing, right? They took the number of cases of COVID, and by the way, of course, they're using very soft endpoints in these studies. And as part of the EBM issue, no one really learns in medical school anymore how to pick apart a study. They don't get this kind of training
right.
that you need to be able to analyze a study and say, this is hogwash. But one of the things that they do is they choose a soft endpoint. And that's what they did in these studies. The endpoint was not reduction in mortality, that's a hard endpoint. Not reduction in hospitalization, it's a hard endpoint. No, it was the reduction of serious symptoms. Well, what's a serious symptom? So the whole thing is very fungible from the beginning, and it makes you wonder. And other things about how these studies were presented and done makes you also wonder, such as the 3,400 or so patients that they said had suspected but unconfirmed disease that they eliminated from the analysis. So things like that make you wonder.
Well, but let's, the 95%. Yeah, yep. let's even stipulate that at their inception or in the preclinicals that the vaccines were very effective. And you know, I said to myself, okay, you know, 95%, that sounds a little too good to be true. TBT. But
yes.
Let's see what happens in the post-marketing studies. We're very familiar with that because we've seen a lot of drugs introduced. I think you are well aware of the Celebrex and the Vyax fiascos. These were introduced as revolutionary new drugs to curb inflammation that would not have any negative effects on the stomach and were going to be, you know, the bomb against any inflammatory disorders. And then what we saw was a lot of side effects emerged afterwards, and B, lack of efficacy beyond, you know, just taking an ordinary Advil for very expensive drugs. So that, you know, countless experiences with that for us veteran physicians made us skeptical. But what I'm about to say is we did not envision, or perhaps some of us who were naive and gullible did not envision, that there would be a breakthrough. And what we're seeing is we're seeing an awful breakthrough, especially with the new variant, the Omicron variant. And it suggests that we're moving the goalposts continually on the vaccines. Like, hey, like, great. You know, everybody needs a booster now. Maybe in Israel, they're talking about a fourth shot, and on it goes. We're going to formulate new tweaks on the vaccine and keep kicking the ball down the field. And by the way, this is not to diminish, in my opinion, the efficacy of the vaccine at curbing the severity of COVID. I think it's fairly well established that in the vast majority of cases, people who get COVID have less severe COVID when they take the vaccine. But the question is the risk-benefit equation, the durability of this, and also our distraction from other plausible therapies, from therapeutics as opposed to preventives.
Right. And the amazing hype and coercion to give it to everybody in the world, literally, through force of losing your job, which is what happened to me. You know, I refused to take the shot because I'm skeptical. I wanted more information about it, and I wasn't going to take it. And St. George's University, where I was teaching, said, no, you have to take it. You're going on administrative leave. And that is my status with them.
Yeah. To the detriment of that institution and your students, not just for you personally.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, yeah, because they have a gifted experienced practitioner on their faculty. And, you know, because of that, the rigidity around that rule. And that's happening, that's multiplied by thousands and tens of thousands across the country, dedicated health professionals, many of whom have had COVID, plausibly believe that they have natural immunity and they're being forced to take the vaccine. And in Europe, they take a more nuanced approach in many countries.
Yeah, that's true. Europe is probably under less pharma pressure than the U.S., which is where it's focused. Yeah, no, I also eventually got COVID. I have antibodies. I'm immune. All the variants, they can come after me. I'm not going to worry about them. I was also practicing nephrology down there on the island and doing dialysis, which they badly needed, by the way, and to not be able to stay there. And the government, of course, imposed the vaccine passport. So I'm not allowed back in the country. Wow. So they've lost a good clinician. What can I say? I feel horrible for the people down there. They're being abused. They're my friends, they're my family now. I mean, I really just, it's a very sad story what's going on down there. And they had no COVID. They had zero COVID on the island for over a year. And I advised them, I said, look at what happened in the Seychelles. Look at what happened in Gibraltar. Look at what happened in Israel, in the UK. Everywhere they've had big vaccine rollouts, there's a huge Delta surge. And this is exactly what happened down there. They were zero COVID, then they suddenly had, like, you know, 1,000 cases and over 100 dead. They had one death over the entire course of the pandemic. Now they have well over 100, all of it preventable. So very sad what's going on there. But where were we? I mean, the relative risk reduction in the Pfizer shot, I knew right away that this was going to be bogus. And I pointed this out to the school. I said the absolute risk reduction in Pfizer was 0.7%. Mm-hmm. So when you see that, and you see that they don't report it, they kept it out of their filing. And that's why Ron Brown deserved credit, Malcolm Kendrick, and Peter Doshi, one of the intrepid editors of the intrepid British Medical Journal, who I have to give a hat tip to, he has done fabulous. Yeah,
they're a little bit more open-minded than some of the other journals. The other journals are very monolithically lockstep with the mainstream narrative. But BMJ gets to publish occasionally some somewhat dissenting viewpoints.
Yes, and Peter Doshi has been great on this whole issue, taking apart the Pfizer data. And he actually testified at another Ron Johnson Senate hearing, which is well worth finding if you can find these things, because they censor them so quickly, again, shockingly. But he brought up the Tamiflu story. Remember that?
Yes,
one?
Yes, and that's another fiasco, right? Yeah, the government bought another up like fiasco. A huge stockpiles of Tamiflu in the face of, I guess it was H1N1, because they, right. You know, everybody should take that. But then it turned out to be a flash in the pan. It wasn't such a terrible pandemic, and besides, Tamiflu became the virus became resistant to it, right?
Well, it was more than that.
And side effects.
I think, yeah, that's right. The Cochrane Group and others suggested that we review the source data. And they asked, I think it was Roche, please turn it over so we can check out your numbers.
Right.
They refused. And they took him to court. And the BMJ, and I think Peter Doshi was involved in this, was part of this legal battle that went on for 3 years. And they finally got the source data on Tamiflu, and it was a bust. Mm-hmm. It barely did any good, right? It might have, you know, shortened the hospital stay, kind of like remdesivir, by the way, and had a lot of nasty side effects that were underreported. So the source data is everything.
And by the way, the source data is locked up for the vaccines, I believe. There's some provision whereby it cannot be released for, 55 years or something like that?
Yeah. Well, they're releasing it at such a sluggish pace that it would be over 50 years before it's all released. So this is unthinkable malfeasance on the part of the FDA, who gave emergency use authorization for this shot and these other shots, with based on what were obviously, to me, shoddy, worrisome pharma-sponsored studies, without asking for the source data. And you embark on a vaccinate the entire world campaign based on the say-so of Pfizer, which is a criminal organization. I mean, you should see the number of cases they've had against them.
Yes, and with major fines as well in many cases, yeah.
Yes, it's outrageous. Outrageous. How can you do this as a public servant supposed to protect the public?
Well, how you do it is you turn this into the zombie apocalypse, and then, you know, the floodgates open for approvals. You know, we need a measured response. Look, this is a devastating pandemic. There's no question that there's a lot of death associated with this. And, but, you know, we need to take a more, measured approach to this, and by protecting the vulnerable. You know, mandates, lockdowns, the horrible social and economic dislocation that this has caused, a lot of missteps made. From your analysis, you know, what's in it for Fauci? I personally don't think Fauci is a money guy. I think he's well off. I think he's done well. But I think it's more about power and legacy, and a mistaken belief in, you know, his mission to save the planet. What's your take?
It's hard to say. I mean, I admired Fauci in the early days. I was very into, I had a patient who I diagnosed during my residency days with Wegener's granulomatosis. So I naturally read all his papers on Wegener's, which, by the way, were not RCTs, right? They were not randomized controlled trials ever.
Right.
They were always observational trials, but they were very helpful.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is a rare disease and very lethal. And when you have a drug treatment protocol that seems to work, you publish the results. And yes, this is how we practiced medicine back in the good old days. So I admired him for that. But then he became entrenched as a bureaucrat. He's established quite a power base there. He controls many billions in funding. So he has an iron grip on so many institutions around the country who depend on NIH and NIAID grants, that he can tell them what to do, and they do it. But he is clearly involved with the gain of function research, funding it through the EcoHealth Alliance.
They offshored it. It was something that really wasn't permitted in the U.S. And they said, well, you know, we've got to do it. So let's do it with our partners in China. Yeah, go for it.
That's right. That's right. He's involved in the vaccine development process. I think he has money tied up in that. Mm-hmm. He was heavily promoting Gilead's remdesivir. I'm sure that they are into him in some way. He was acting like a drug shill. I mean, right. We know these people.
Right? Well, there's a certain amount of
over and over again.
It seems to me there's a certain amount of entrepreneurship by the government, because the government partners and actually makes money off of pursuing these strategies, right?
They make our money off of pursuing this strategy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's been great all around for these big players. Absolutely. They've never had it so good. And that's why, by the way, it's never going to end. Sorry to break it to your listeners, but there will be no end to this. Variant after variant will come along. The variants, of course, emerge because of the selective pressure applied by these ineffective leaky shots.
I agree with you, Richard. You know, a lot of people have said the opposite. They've said it's the unvaccinated who are causing the variants to arise, because if we can only eradicate the virus, then there wouldn't be any vulnerable people to act as petri dishes to allow it to mutate and proliferate. But I think it's the opposite. I agree with you. And I've read scientific papers that suggest that leaky vaccines that are only partially effective, put selective pressure on the virus. The virus has gone virus. It wants to elude the vaccines, and it keeps It speeds the development of variants.
It does, and to the extent that they do get the body to produce antibodies, they're not neutralizing, and in fact, they may facilitate entry of the viruses into cells, and they also compete with your innate antibody system, and make you more vulnerable to infection. And in fact, there is a big increase in COVID infections immediately following the first shot. Hmm. And these tricky guys, okay, have figured out, and you can see this in all the original papers, that they don't really start counting until 2 weeks after the second shot.
They say, well, it takes time to kick in.
That's, that's what they say.
Yeah.
That's their rationale.
Yeah.
But of course, it should all be based on intention to treat analysis, where as soon as you randomize, you're in that group and that your outcome must be recorded. Even if you get nothing, right? But certainly if you get one shot and don't get the others, you should, and you die, let's say, between your first and second shot, which I'm sure people did, that must be recorded as a treatment effect.
Yeah.
But they didn't do that. They start the counting 2 weeks after the second shot. So it's unscrupulous and it's trickery. I mean, it's fraud, frankly. So, yeah, I don't think the shots were ever effective against death. They've never shown that. They've never been shown to block even transmission. We know that. It's obvious now they don't.
That was the claim at first, stop the spread, do your part and that whole thing. And then there's still people, to this day, there are people who, if you have not been vaccinated, and you've experienced this because you say you've not been vaccinated, they think you're Typhoid Mary. They don't want to be in the same room with you, right?
That's right.
Friends, relatives, you get basically canceled.
Exactly. They've launched this incredible campaign to demonize unvaccinated people. Again, unprecedented. Well, unless you consider, the Nazi era, when they got a segregated group and blamed the ills of the world on this group, then you can go back to that era. But we've never done this before. And the unvaccinated, most of them have natural antibodies at this point. The disease has been around the block many times. Everybody's been exposed. I had it. It's not fun, but you survive and you get antibodies.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that probably
is the way that this is going to end, because the vaccine's less efficacious. People will catch new variants, hopefully in a milder form. And, as our experience in New York is doing pretty well, but that's because we got body slammed in the early phases of this. And there's such a high degree of background natural immunity that, There's less of a problem now. All right, there's lots to unpack in this, you know, in this subject. But you know, you've done a good job introducing us to some of the aspects of the tyranny of evidence-based medicine. I suggest you look it up. We'll provide a link to our listeners in the show synopsis. EBM is, according to today's guest, it encourages totalitarian medicine, and governments use EBM to control the practice of medicine, and it's become monolithic and a paint-by-numbers enterprise. Thank you, Dr. Matt Amerling, for joining us today. Information about AAPS and yourself, do you have a website where people can find out about you and also about...
AAPS is certainly worth looking at, and they've got a lot of good COVID information there as well. They hosted, their annual meeting turned into a little mini COVID summit with Peter McCullough, Robert Malone, Richard Urso, Ryan Cole as speakers. It was really sensational. I advise checking out those videos, aapsonline.org. And America's Frontline Doctors also has a tremendous amount of very useful information, aflds.org. And you can find me personally on Twitter, at Dr. Amerling, until they ban me. I'm still there. I guess I'm not too much of a nuisance yet, so I'm sure I'll get there eventually.